on today's Run to the Top podcast.
The message I hope people come away from the book with is not, I should go buy this pill or invest in that brain stimulation device, but that how much I'm able to push myself and what the limits of my endurance are fundamentally a function of what's going on in my brain, and they respond to what I believe is I'm capable of.
Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast from Runners Connect, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. Together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now here's your host, Stephanie K. Atwood.
Welcome. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, Boston Marathon qualifier, coach, and host for the Run to the Top podcast. What do you know about endurance? If you haven't read Alex Hutchinson's amazing book called Endure, you will certainly learn a lot more. Alex Hutchinson is a National Magazine Award-winning journalist whose work appears in Outside, The Globe and Mail, The New York Times, The New Yorker, and other publications. His recent book, Endure, goes into great depth and page-turning reading about the brain, the body, and the mind-boggling limits that the body can endure. Alex is here to share the science and the mysteries, is it magic, of endurance, a subject near and dear to all runners. From short sprints to ultra marathons, endurance plays a key factor. We'll meet Alex in a moment after a brief break to thank our Run to the Top sponsors. Want to recover faster from your workouts? Want to sleep better? A few weeks ago, we had Caleb Simpson on the podcast to discuss the research behind the effectiveness of CBD oil when it comes to helping you recover faster. In short, the biggest advantages of CBD for a runner like you are the anti-inflammatory properties and better sleep. If you are skeptical, now is the time to give it a try and check the results for yourself. If you can recover faster and be in less pain, your running is going to be better. If you want to see how CBD can work for you, we've worked out a deal with Hemp Daddy to offer you 15% off on any order and free shipping. Listen to the podcast first and then head to runnersconnect.net/CBD and use the code RTTT for the special offer. Welcome back to the Run to the Top podcast and today's guest, Alex Hutchinson, who will be sharing his vast knowledge on the brain and body topic that we call endurance. Alex has written a New York Times bestseller book called Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. He's also a former Canadian national team distance runner. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks so much, Stephanie. It's really great to be here.
I am so excited to interview you. I mean, endurance is just something that all of us are so curious about, and you have a lot of information to share. Let's start, though, with the first four. Always do every podcast with this as our first part. So your current age, where you were born, where you are currently living, and what is your favorite current race distance?
All right. So my age is 43. I'll be turning 44 later this year. I was born in Toronto, Canada. And although I spent about 20 years living away in the US and Australia and Britain, I'm now back in Toronto. And not only that, I'm sitting here speaking to you from the house I grew up in. I was able to work out the timing to elbow my parents out at just the right moment. So I'm like a salmon swimming back upstream. I'm back in my home haunts.
Yeah.
And and my favorite race distance is these days it's settled into be the 5K. The sort of shortest long distance or the longest short distance, depending on how you want to look at it.
That works for me. Okay, well, we are going to go into, I have so many questions for you, and I'd like you to start off by telling us a bit about your background as it relates to your credentials as a scientist, a runner, and a journalist, because they're pretty darn extensive, all three.
Oh, well, thanks. So I should say, I do have credentials as a runner. Those are real. I've been running since I was a kid. I think I joined my school's cross country team in grade 3, and I started training pretty seriously in high school and competed through high school and university. And after university, I was able to compete for the Canadian national team in track and cross country for a number of years. And I would say my serious competitive career It's petered out in my late 20s, early 30s, but I still run pretty much every day and I compete periodically. And when I say I run every day, you know, I do interval workouts and tempo runs a couple times a week. I just enjoy the process of training. So it's been part of my life.
Yeah.
Pretty much for my whole life.
Understood.
I claim to be a scientist on TV. That not quite, but I write about science and I have a PhD in science. So people sometimes assume that those two things are related, and they are, but only peripherally. My educational background is actually in physics. I did an undergraduate degree and then a PhD in physics, and then worked as a postdoctoral researcher for a few years. And it was only in my late 20s, when I was 28, I sort of had my seeing the light moment and decided this wasn't what I wanted to do. And I ended up going back to school and doing a master's in journalism, and then starting out as a freelance journalist, writing about various things, and ended up sort of gravitating towards, you can sort of think of running was the big passion in my life, and science, and specifically physics, was my occupation. And if you sort of try and merge those two things, what you get is the science of exercise or the science of endurance. But the truth is, I'm not an exercise scientist, and I never studied exercise physiology or anything. And I don't use, you know, Newton's laws or anything that I studied as a physicist very much. So I have a scientific background and a scientific frame of mind and reference and way of thinking about the world. But I don't write about exercise science as an insider. I write about it as a commentator or an observer.
And one of the things that I noticed about your book, which I always love this when people document and research and get a lot of outside information to utilize in their journalism. And so you seem to have done a very good job of that with all of the writing that I've seen that you've done. So as a journalist who makes reading really easy for those of us who only like reading books, you know, not white papers and that kind of stuff, you really include a lot of good detail and back it up with excellent stories as well as research from other people. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And I would say, in a sense, if I had to sort of encapsulate what I think mission is maybe a too grandiose a word, but what I try and do, or what the service that I can provide, is a translation from that scientific world to the sort of more general world, because not all of us have the time or the inclination or the desire to wade through scientific papers or even the access. Because even I would say, when I was competing seriously, I didn't even realize there were all these scientists studying the questions I was interested in, because there wasn't a whole lot of translation.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I try and translate it so that it's accessible, but not just simplify it to the point where you lose the nuance and the detail. Because I know there's a lot of people who are really interested in getting into the nitty gritty. And so I try and make it accessible, but still detailed.
I'm one of those. I love the details. I love the research. I love the backing up of hunches and observations with other people's hunches and observations and potential decent research. Some of it isn't necessarily great research, or it changes over the years, but it's there.
Absolutely.
Now, was there a tipping point that moved you into studying and writing about endurance as your focus?
Yeah, it wasn't intentional, to be honest. I started out after journalism school. I started out as a general assignment reporter with a newspaper, so you know, covering the car crashes and the dog fashion shows and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Did that for about a year and a half, and then I started out as a freelancer. And my first gig as a freelancer was actually, there's a Canadian publication called The Bottom Line, which is Canada's accounting monthly.
Mm.
And so I was going to accounting conferences as a freelancer and writing about the Sarbanes-Oxley rules and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was willing to write about just about anything, and I didn't have any preconceptions. But one thing that happened that was sort of a tipping point is, towards the end of my newspaper time, I did a big long feature about the Kenyan runners who were coming to the Ottawa Marathon. This is a very common phenomenon, you know, around the world, local races. The young men and women from Kenya show up and win the top prizes and then disappear. And people don't know a lot about them. So I pitched the idea, why don't I go and spend some time with the defending champion, learn who this guy is, how he makes a living, how he survives running, you know, in a non-lucrative sport, running not the Boston Marathon, but the Ottawa Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so to cut a long story short, I wrote a very long, you know, multi-thousand word feature about the life of these, you know, Kenyans trying to make a living as runners. And it was the best thing I'd ever written by far. And so what some people told me, you know, some of my mentors said, is that it's really clear when you write about things that you have a passion for that it comes through in your writing, and then you do your best writing. And so that encouraged me. I'd been trying to shy away from sort of just sticking to my hobby horses, but that made me think, you know what, there's a benefit to writing about things that I really care about, that I'll be able to do my best work.
And so, okay, that was kind of the turnover in terms of your writing career. But there was also a story about you overcoming this, well, maybe this is the endurance book, you overcoming you got stuck in the 1500 and couldn't get over it. And then you did. And maybe that was what the impetus was for this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So the book, you mentioned the book Endure, and in a way I spent about 10 years or 9 or 10 years working on this. And at a certain point you start to ask yourself, like, what am I doing? Why am I so obsessed with this? And it was at some point thinking about that question that I tried to trace back, where does this come from? Why am I so interested in this? And I was able to trace it back to a race that I ran in university in 1996, which seems like a long time ago now. Where, like you said, I was a 1500 meter runner in college, and my goal in life was to break 4 minutes for the 1500, which is, it's kind of like the poor man's version of the 4 minute mile. It's about 17 seconds shorter than a mile. And it was, you know, it's a very meaningful number, right? 4 minutes has a lot of resonance for runners. And I'd been stuck, like you said, for 4 years. I had run 4:02 in my second year of running in high school. I figured it'd be easy to break through, but I ended up being stuck at that level, 4:01 or 4:02 for 4 straight years. And so that really gave me the feeling that I was approaching my physical limits, that maybe I could go 3:59, but I was knocking on the door of what my body was capable of. And what ended up happening is I had this crazy race in a meaningless meet where I went out, and it was an indoor race, so a 200 meter track. And when in a lot of these track races, you have a timekeeper who calls out your splits as you, every time you pass the start line. And, you know, the first split I heard was 27 seconds, which is way too fast. And so I had this disconnect between how I felt and what my brain was telling me, which is that I was in big trouble. And so this went on for the first few laps of me thinking, what's going on? I must be having an amazing day because the splits are so fast. And yet I feel actually quite relaxed. And so at a certain point, about a third of the way through the race, I just thought, oh my God, something special is happening. You know, stop listening to the splits and just put your head down and go for it. And I ended up finishing that race in 3:52.4, which is a 9 second personal best after 4 years of being stuck. And the sort of the postscript is, you know, as I was celebrating with my teammates, one of them had timed my splits for me so that I could put them in my training log and, you know, analyze them obsessively for months. And what it turned out is the splits I'd heard were completely wrong. The timekeeper had probably, I don't know exactly what happened, but it seems like he must have missed the start and started his watch maybe 3 seconds late. So he was calling out these splits, making me think that I was having a great day. And as a result, I did. And so that really changed my perception and my understanding of what it meant to be at your limit, to cross the line and think that's everything I could do. Because suddenly from 1 week to the next, I had uncovered this sort of hidden reserve. And so from then on, I could never really trust when I finished a race that, I no longer had that feeling of like, I guess that's as fast as my body is capable of going. Instead, it was, I wonder if there's more and how can I can access it. And I think that ended up being the seed that was sort of rankling in my mind for years afterwards, and ended up leading to the book.
And training wise and everything, you had not, or if anything, you had trained better to get to this point where you broke that race where you were stuck, the race time. So all the pieces were there, but you had been in good shape all along, right? I mean, you were really working as hard as you could to try and break this record.
Yeah, there was no obvious change. And it's funny, after the book came out, I got a call from my old high school coach who had read the story, and he was like, there must have been more signs than that, that you were going to have a breakthrough. And I said, look, for sure. I mean, even before that, I knew it's just a matter of time. I knew I could go a little faster, but I said, look, if you don't believe me, look, I'll lend you my old training logs. I dug up my old training logs. And I gave them to my old coach who was, you know, he was my high school coach. He also guided me in the summers during university. So he was my coach when I had this, this race. And he looked through the old training logs just as a sort of trip down memory lane. And he was like,
right.
Yeah, you're right. You know, like there's no sort of smoking gun that, I mean, sure.
Right.
I don't think it was just a question that all of a sudden one day mentally it was magical. There was obviously physically I must've been ready for that breakthrough in some way, but it wasn't a case where things had changed or I'd started new workouts or started training harder.
Right.
I was training pretty consistently for the previous few years.
Yeah. So the question, of course, is, how did your brain fit into this? And I guess that's what your book has been about over this last 10, 15 years that you've been researching it. Can you start off with defining endurance as you did in the book?
Yeah, sure. And it's harder than you think when you sit down to try. What is endurance? And, you know, as a runner, you start thinking maybe it's my VO2 max or my lactate threshold. But the definition that I ended up getting from the scientific literature is that it's the struggle to continue against a mounting desire to stop. And that's it's a very general definition in a sense, because it absolutely applies to, let's say, running a marathon, but it also mm-hmm. applies to a lot of other aspects in life that we often think of as more metaphorical, mm-hmm. Whether dealing with a difficult person or studying for an exam. But one of the things that's interesting to me is through the research I did for the book, I came up with this understanding of endurance as something that's more about the brain than about the muscles. And so in mm-hmm. that sense, it's all kind of the same. It's not just a metaphor. What you need to run a marathon is very comparable to what you need to study for an exam or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, I love that definition. I think that's really good. And we can all relate to it with this idea of struggling because that's universal. That's not just races, and it's also not just fast racers. It's all of us that have to get through some of this stuff.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
We're enduring. Your book starts with the mind and muscle section and includes your prediction. This was several years ago, that the sub-2-hour marathon would fall in 2075. So clearly, this was pre-Nike. And how did you come up with your prediction? And then what are your thoughts now on that subject?
Yeah, I'm never going to live that prediction down.
It's great because you worked really hard on putting the pieces together to make that happen.
Yeah. So Runner's World asked me to do a big 10-page feature that involved, talking to lots of scientists, analyzing a bunch of data, trying to figure mm-hmm. out what it would mm-hmm. take to run a sub-2-hour marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, I felt duty bound to stake out my prediction.
Yeah, tough
and,
one.
And I will say the 2075 number reflects a little bit my inherent sort of skepticism or pessimism that I always prefer to sort of sound more pessimistic and then be pleasantly surprised rather than sound too optimistic. So I wouldn't have been surprised if it was 2060 or something like that, but I still mm-hmm. thought we were a long way away. This was 2014.
Right. Right.
And
okay.
then, just 2 years later, I got a call from my editor at Runner's World saying, hey, Nike's about to announce this project that they've spent, several years and tens of millions of dollars on. They've invited us to go behind the scenes and cover it. Do you want to go cover it? And I was like, well, what do you mean? They're going to do a sub-2-hour. They want to do a sub-2-hour marathon next year because I'm going to look like an idiot. I said it won't happen until 2075. But as history knows, Eliud Kipchoge ended up running 2 hours, 0 minutes, and 25 seconds in 2017. That wasn't an official marathon, but still, it kind of changed everyone's, including my, perspective on when this might happen in the real world. And so now, mm-hmm. If I had to make a prediction now, I would say it kind of depends a little bit on what happens with, what we've already seen. There's a project coming up this fall,
mm-hmm.
The INEOS 159 project, where a very rich guy in Britain has put up a bunch of money for Eliud Kipchoge to take another crack at breaking sub-2, again, and not in a real world record scenario.
Yep.
But because there's excitement surrounding it, if there's more attempts like this where they stage situations in a really optimal course and at a really mm-hmm. optimal time, but do mm-hmm. it in a way that's eligible for a world record,
mm-hmm.
then I think it might happen sooner than the curves would suggest. Personally, I would say maybe 20 years, but I wouldn't mm-hmm. be surprised to see it in 5 or 10, mm. Just because as we get closer and closer, more and more attention and more money are going to be drawing people to take a crack at it.
And this comes back to that whole brain thing. They probably calculations, because I know you worked really hard on it, on that 2075 prediction. But the brain is such an unknown in so many ways. And this actually brings me kind of to my next question, which is that it isn't just about mathematics. And this is one of the controversies that you address in a lot of the chapters of your book. There's math and there's science and there's research. And then there's this unknown that just seems to keep coming up over and over again in so many different ways.
Yeah. And so, an interesting example of that is, so when Eliud Kipchoge ran this 2-hour Zoom and it's 25 seconds, not official world record, I was there watching it, and even as skeptical and dispassionate as I try to be as a journalist, there was this very special feeling as that happened of like, someone has just done this remarkable thing. How can anyone ever again sort of think that 201 is impossible? Mm-hmm. And so I ended up after that just thinking that will change how people run the marathon. It won't change their VO2 max. It won't change their lactate threshold. It'll change how people train, what people think of as their goals. And so I thought, I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a couple months later saying, I think Eliud Kipchoge is going to run 201 at the Berlin Marathon. And it's going to be because his conception of what's possible has changed thanks to Breaking 2. Now he didn't. It was a rainy day in Berlin, and so he didn't do it. So he ran, at the London Marathon the next fall. It was the hottest London Marathon on record. So again, he didn't do it. But finally, a year later at the next Berlin Marathon in 2018, he ran 201. It's not like he just decided to run 201 and it's all in his head. It's clearly a physical thing too, but I don't think he would have been out there trying to run 201 if he hadn't had that transformative barrier breaking experience with the Breaking 2 project, sort of in the same way that for me, once I ran that 352 1500, I never again struggled to break 4 minutes. And in fact, I got faster in my races after that.
Yeah, very interesting. And I love the questions I have here because I'm so curious about them myself. But we're talking about obviously incredible physical training, but we're also talking about, in Eliud Kipchoge's case, how the brain interprets pain. And you might have a few other stories to share with me, but the way that the brain looks at pain and deals with pain is a fascinating part of your book. So can you talk about that a bit more?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so there's a lot of different theories, that I don't think we'll get into super depth today, but in terms of to try and explain, how do we incorporate the brain into our understanding of endurance? Like, what role does the brain play? It's not just like, are you trying hard enough? It plays a deeper role. And the theory that I find most convincing is that the real master switch that determines whether you can speed up or slow down or stop or whatever during a race is your subjective perception of effort. It's how does it feel? How hard does it feel? And that, of course, depends on all the physical things that we normally think of. It depends on how hard you're breathing, how hard your heart is pounding, how much lactate is in your legs. But it also depends on other things. Since it's a feeling of effort, it also depends on your outlook, your confidence, your motivation. And so that means, of course, the best way to get faster is go out and train hard. But there are other ways of getting faster that involve, reframing how we interpret discomfort or pain or effort. And so that's one of the things that I think is special about Eliud Kipchoge, is that he explicitly thinks in this way. One of the things that really stood out for me is that I, in covering that Breaking 2 project, is I met Kipchoge for the first time 6 months before the race, and he had just run a half marathon in just under an hour. So he was basically going to have to go twice the distance at the same pace he had just raced if he wanted to run a 2-hour marathon. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I thought this would be great for Runner's World. We can get some good training details. So I asked him, Eliud, what are the changes you're going to make in your training that will allow you to go twice as far at the same pace? And his answer was, I'm not going to change my training. My training will be the same, but my mind will be different. Which at the time I thought was an absolutely silly answer. I thought, this project is doomed if that's your plan. Hmm. But later I came to sort of appreciate that he was really sincere about this, that to him, part of the process of preparation was preparing his mind to accept what it would feel like to go through the half marathon in an hour and to view that pain and discomfort that he would be feeling not as a sign that he was in trouble, but as a sign that he was on track, and to frame it as a sign that he was doing what he planned to do. So there, you know, pain and effort are subtly different things. Things can be hard without being painful, and they can be painful without being hard. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of interesting discussion to be had about that. But the bottom line is, the way we intuit it is that if I feel a pain in my leg, that's this objective thing, or a pain or discomfort or effort that tells me I have to stop. It means that, it's like if I look at my car and the fuel gauge says empty, I can't just think, well, maybe the car can keep trying a little bit harder, mm-hmm. and it'll get there. The car, when the fuel gauge says empty, the car is out of gas. But humans aren't quite like that, and or at least our fuel gauge is much less reliable, and we often tend to get the sign that the radiator is overheated or the fuel gauge is empty at a point when it's not actually, it's just getting close. And so if we can learn to reinterpret those signals and to say, yes, it's very uncomfortable right now. My body wants me to stop. My brain wants me to stop, but I know I actually have a little bit more in reserve. And so maybe I can keep pushing for a little longer.
Now, training the brain itself is something that Eliud Kipchoge, he just is so talented and so beyond really almost anybody else in the world. But training the brain to fatigue is something that I think a lot of us have experienced and have improved by literally just tiring our brain out so much over some period of time that it changes the way that we're perceiving something. So can you talk about that some?
Yeah, and I should say, I think one thing that's really underappreciated is the extent to which in the course of ordinary everyday training or running, mm-hmm. of course, we're changing our bodies, we're training our bodies, but we are also always training our minds. Mm-hmm. And so, if you're someone who's started running recently, if you think back to what those first runs felt like, when someone just starts running and they get out of breath, they sort of interpret that signal that it means they're about to die or that they have to stop.
Right.
And the more you run and the more time you spend kind of around that knife edge or holding your finger in the flame, the more you realize, oh, okay, that feeling I've got is not a stop sign. It's not a stoplight. It's more of a warning light. It tells me I'm going to have to stop, but I don't have to pull back quite as soon. And you'll learn to push it a little bit farther and a little bit farther. So that's something that happens naturally and organically as part of training. And there's lots of research showing in athletes showing that their pain tolerance and their ability to tolerate discomfort improves as they get fitter. So it's not just that their legs are stronger and their heart's stronger. It's also that they're willing to suffer more.
And that they understand that, in fact, they aren't going to die. They haven't died. They're still running.
It's like learning the difference between, shin splints and just a sore shin. Mm-hmm. You have to learn the difference between, because sometimes you do have signals to stop, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're just warnings. And so you gradually learn that when I'm breathing like this, I can keep going a little bit longer. When I'm breathing like that, I'm cooked. So you start to become a connoisseur of that. But aside from that sort of natural process, mm-hmm. one of the things that's emerged in the last few years is the idea that maybe sometimes we should deliberately train our brain. Mm-hmm. So independent of what's going of training our muscles, we should do specifically mentally fatiguing tasks, mm-hmm. which will help train our brain to tolerate mental fatigue a little better. So that's a sort of new frontier of performance
science. Can you give an example of that?
Yeah. So the protocol that I tried when this idea was just being proposed in 2013, I did 12 weeks of brain training, which involved sitting in front of my computer and for let's say 5 days a week for, up to an hour or sometimes even more at a time. And it was very simple. Little shapes or arrows or letters would flash on the screen, and I'd have to hit a button corresponding to the direction of the arrow or the color of the letter, mm-hmm. or things like that. So very simple, like an 8-year-old could do these tasks,
right.
But you have to sit there and respond as quickly as possible. And you're sitting there for an hour, mm. and it's absolutely challenging to sustain your focus for that time, in the same way that it's challenging to, if you're running a marathon, keep overcoming your natural and logical desire to slow down. You have to keep overcoming, inhibiting your natural response and overcoming that. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of the same thing with these brain training games. Now, the research on this is really still very preliminary, but it's very promising. It suggests that it might work. But my practical experience with it was to say that if you told me that I could spend an hour a day, 5 days a week doing these brain games and it would get me 2 minutes faster in my marathon, I'd say, you know, I'm happy where I am right now.
Uh-huh.
It might be different if I was, you know, 2 minutes from qualifying for the Olympics or something like that, but it's really unpleasant. And so in the last year or two, where people are trying to move it is trying to find ways of making brain training a little more humane, let's say, or something that people might be willing to do. So I was speaking to a scientist recently who worked with the Danish Olympic Committee, one of the guys who developed this sort of brain training protocol, and they've started using it during interval workouts, where instead of you doing it for an hour at a time, you're doing it in the middle of a hard interval workout where you're already physically and mentally fatigued. And during your rest periods, while your body's resting, you run over to an iPad and do some mentally fatiguing tasks. So you're still stressing your brain while your body recovers. Mm. And that way you can get some benefit without having to sit there for an hour. It's a sort of more efficient way of getting the stimulus. So, you know, I think that aspect of brain training is fascinating from a theoretical point of view. It's like, wow, I can get faster at the marathon by sitting at my computer. I don't think it's going to be like the next big thing.
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of work for a little return.
Right.
But I think the insight that's maybe more generally applicable, and one of the things the scientist said to me, one of the scientists said to me when I was asking about this is, look, the bigger change is to recognize that mental fatigue is a training stimulus. And so maybe that what that ends up meaning is you have a sleepless night because you have a sick child, or you are up late for whatever reason, mm-hmm, for work, mm-hmm, and or you have a long day at work and your temptation is, oh man, I was supposed to do a hard workout today, but I'm fried. I didn't get enough sleep, or I'm stressed out. I'm going to delay my workout.
Right.
And so what the scientist said is, hey, maybe sometimes just go ahead with your workout.
Yeah.
Understand that it's going to be a little slower, mm-hmm, but think of it as practice in tolerating this sort of mental fatigue. You're getting a brain training workout where the it's still a physical workout, but the emphasis has shifted a little more to the brain compared to the usual. So it's a way of kind of making lemonade out of lemons. If you think you're too mentally tired to do a good workout, reframe it in your mind as a mental training workout.
Interesting. That's very interesting, because of course there's got to be some kind of boundary for that as well. I mean, you can overdo it and hurt yourself, get sick, whatever. So it's
yeah, absolutely. Or lose the pleasure of training if you're constantly training in a mentally stressed state.
Yeah.
So you do, recovery is as important mentally as it is physically. And I would add that's another sort of insight that comes from this research is when you're preparing for a race, think of a mental taper as well as a physical taper. You don't run 100 miles a week the week before your marathon. You also shouldn't do your taxes on the Saturday before a marathon. You know, you need to give yourself a chance to be both mentally and physically at the top of your game when you're competing.
Interesting. Perception of effort kind of fits into this. It's definitely a brain thing, and you talk about it a lot in several different chapters in your book. How do elite athletes use this to their advantage?
Yeah, well, interestingly, in some cases, I'm not sure they do use it as much as they should, because there's a real focus on technology, and it's like, I'm going to track my training and my racing with, you know, my GPS watch and my power meter, mm-hmm, and my heart rate variability, mm-hmm, device, and there's the illusion, I think, that you can know everything about yourself by measuring it with wearable technology. Uh-huh. And what the science tends to suggest, you know, this is controversial, but I think what the research suggests to me, at least, is that when you stack up training monitoring with a bunch of wearable technology versus training monitoring by at the end of each run saying, how hard was that on a scale of 1 to 10? What you find is that the supercomputer between your ears is a much more effective integrator of all the signals that, you know, it's the mental stress, the physical stress, the psychological stress that tells you how hard you're working. So a lot of elite athletes, not all of them, but a lot of elite athletes, even if they're using GPS watches and heart rate monitors and all these sorts of things, they also in their training log have a spot where they, let's say on a scale of 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, right? How hard did that run feel today? Because then they can compare that and say, boy, I did that workout. I did a very similar workout a month ago, and I called it a 5 out of 10. Today I did it. I called it a 7 out of 10. That suggests something's not right. I'm going in the wrong, or it's 3 out of 10, mm-hmm. and I'm getting fitter. So the comparison between the subjective and the objective data is more interesting, I think, than either one of them on its own. But the real insight is that the best body measurement tool we have is the brain that's getting all the signals from every part of the body.
And we can trick that brain. This is having a Garmin that's set up, or some kind of metric that is giving us the wrong measurement, either in a negative direction or in a positive direction. Like you were saying with the timing, with the digital timing on the track, that can impact your perception of effort.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a whole subfield of research that's involved in ways of deceiving people to see what mm-hmm. happens. It's actually one of my favorite bodies of research because it's so funny. They do studies where they give people, you know, clocks that run slow or fast, which is just kind of like my race. or there was one where they actually, they had these cyclists doing a study in a heat chamber, and they rigged up and they had a rectal thermometer and a room thermometer. And for both of them, they rigged the thermometers to display a falsely low temperature. And what they found is that the cyclists, now heat isn't all in your head, heat is real, but part of the slowdown of heat is because you believe you're getting hot. And so if the temperature is reading lower than it should, you end up going faster than you would otherwise. So there's all these ways in which we can be tricked, or we can trick ourselves. And if we're able to harness that sometimes, and you know, competition is a great example. If you think you can stay with a competitor, then there's a good chance you will, even if that competitor is going faster than you mm-hmm. realize. And they've shown that in the lab mm-hmm. too. So this is another reminder that what we feel like are our physical limits are actually really influenced by what we believe is going on, and how we think we feel. So there's not that you can suddenly decide to I'm going to win the Olympics because I believe it, but within a sort of range of outcomes, you can push, you can trick yourself both for the better and for the worse without really realizing it.
Defense mechanism. You talk about how our brain, it might be telling us to stop, but in fact, it's really kind of preparing us for that. We don't want to keep doing this a whole lot longer, or it could be a problem, but in fact, we're not even close to our limit.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's an interesting question, because one point that people often make is, well, if the brain thinks you should stop and you figure out how to trick yourself, are you going to kill yourself? Yeah. Are you going to do yourself some long-term damage? And it's a good question. So what the question effectively is asking is, how big is the safety margin?
Right.
How much reserve mm-hmm. do we have? Are we really close? And if we borrow a little bit from that reserve, are we risking hurting ourselves? And I don't have a solid answer, and I don't think science does either. But my feeling is that the safety reserve is very, very large, and that the closer you get to it, the harder it gets to keep pushing back. So I think we generally tend to have lots of room to maneuver. There are some exceptions. One example is doing really hard long races, like let's say a marathon or a 10K. In mm-hmm. really hot conditions, that's one situation where our brain's self-protective mechanisms seem to be a little bit less well-tuned. And so it's very rare, but you do sometimes find people who run themselves into a stupor or, into heat stroke under those conditions. Under more sort of, let's say, normal conditions, or at least normal for Canada, mm-hmm. like moderate conditions, it's almost impossible. Like I could go, you could offer me $1,000 to run myself unconscious, or I don't know how much, you could offer me any amount. I don't think I could run myself into a coma. Like I would just get too tired eventually. Like we have this very, very effective thing called fatigue mm-hmm. which is partly in the body and partly in the mind, that makes it hard to do damage unless you're sort of willfully ignoring common sense by, heading out in the desert and not drinking
and
or something.
Or
like that.
Using performance enhancers. I really enjoyed the area where you were talking about illegal drugs like methamphetamines and fentanyl, and sort of the supposed benefits of them for athletes, and how they really kind of backfire. And then also legal drugs or legal aids like Tylenol and baking soda. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Yeah, the sort of the possibilities for tweaking with your limits if you decide you're willing to go the pharmaceutical route, both legal or illegal, are almost endless. I was actually just recently on a cycling trip where the cycling guide kept telling us, "Did you know that the latest drug in the peloton is Viagra?" Because it was used for blood circulation originally. So apparently you have apparently all these cyclists are popping Viagra and then trying to climb mountains. So I would say there's not one limiting factor in the body that slows you down, but there are a lot of different factors that can contribute to make effort exercise mm-hmm. feel harder. And you can use various drugs to affect various of these factors and allow you to go a little harder. So one example, like you said, is baking soda. And basically, baking soda controls the pH level, or helps to control the pH level in your blood when you're exercising really hard. It acts as a buffer to prevent your system from going too acidic when you're doing very anaerobic exercise. So you can take baking soda, and for some people, it offers a slight advantage in races lasting about 1 to 20 minutes. Now the problem is it also causes explosive diarrhea in a lot of people. And so it's one of those things where it's like, how bad do you want this? I think I told the story in the book. One of my big breaks in college was I got to be on the 4x800 meter relay team. The first time I qualified for nationals was with that relay team. And I only got my opportunity to run because one of the other runners who was faster than me in theory, was using baking soda during our conference championships. And after four races of taking baking soda, he just couldn't get out of the bathroom. His gastrointestinal issues were so bad that they said the call went out, send in Hutchinson. And so I was like, I've benefited from baking soda. I've never taken it myself, but my performance has been enhanced.
Now, isn't there like carbonation in some of the sports drinks that we would take? Is that the same idea?
You'd need, I'm not sure to what extent that would help because the amount of baking soda you need is substantial. Oh. So I'm not sure by drinking a Coke or anything like that, you could get a benefit. But there are a lot of ingredients in sports drinks, which also play roles, specifically things like carbohydrates, and that's another interesting little byway that, we always think of sports drinks. Oh, I'm taking carbohydrate because it's going to give more fuel for my muscles. But what they find is that you can put a sports drink in your mouth, rinse it around and spit it out, and you'll have a more or less instant performance benefit without even swallowing. And that's another example of, it's not necessarily that your muscles are out of fuel. It's that your brain is worried mm-hmm. that your muscles are going to be out of fuel. So if you have a sweet drink in your mouth, your brain thinks, oh, thank goodness, more fuel is on the way. And your performance is enhanced more or less instantaneously. So it's not just about what's going on in the body. It's about what your brain thinks is going on in the body.
It does seem to me that for a lot of us, if we're listening and we're definitely novice, or at least we're not heavy duty athletes, that pushing a lot of these things probably isn't necessarily a good idea because we don't have anybody watching us, and when you're doing this stuff in a lab or when you're doing it at a high level and people are watching you and measuring you and all of that kind of stuff, then it's definitely it's safer to be able to try and push some of these limits.
I think that's a good point. And I think there's a broader point, which is that, and this is something I worry a lot about or think a lot about in the context of the fact that I write, My day job is writing about a lot of these very subtle mm-hmm. factors that can affect performance. And what I think I sometimes don't convey well enough is that this is the 1% or the 0.1%. And if you want to get faster, the low hanging fruit is run more, recover well, mm-hmm. sleep better, eat well. These things have huge potential for performance improvements that totally dwarf what you might get from, baking soda or beet juice or whatever. And the other thing that I think, I don't want to sound too judgmental here, especially since I make my living writing about this stuff, but is that before taking something, I've written a lot of articles about beet juice, which has, reasonably well established mm-hmm. performance enhancing benefits. But if you're, before you take beet juice or caffeine pills or, you know, any of the other things like that, you need to stop and think a little bit about what it is you're after, what it is that sport is about for you. Because is it about a specific time or is it about seeing how fast you can go? Like, none of us would say, oh, I'm so excited that I set a new personal best for my marathon because I figured out you can cut through that back alley on the turnaround and cut off 400 meters. So, that's obvious. No one disputes that. But it's like, if I take a pill that makes me 1% faster, then where is the triumph or the thrill or the excitement in being 1% faster? Now, I'm not saying I understand the counter arguments. Like, let's say you want to qualify for Boston or something like that, and you're 1% off. I'd be taking that pill too. But I think for me, a lot of this stuff, the interest is intellectual. The interest is trying to understand what the limits are, and knowing that Tylenol can change the limits doesn't make me want to take Tylenol before a race. Definitely not. But it does tell me that something that, yeah, well, if Tylenol changes my limits, that means part of what's holding me back is the feeling of discomfort and not that my legs can't go any faster. So it's a way of understanding where the limits are and what I can do to change them. But as much as I've written about performance enhancers, you know, I've never taken a caffeine pill. I've tried beet juice just once in my life just to see what it was like, because these things aren't really what the sport is about to me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that a lot. Now, I do want to talk about thirst and dehydration. You have some great information there, and I think this is worth us sharing with our listeners. Both the hyponatremia fiasco, that's not as big of a deal now, but there's still hype around it and controversy. And then also people like Alberto Salazar and Haile Gebrselassie, who they have huge sweat loss, 10 pounds lost during a marathon kind of thing. And yet it seems to be feasible for them to do that and still be victorious and not harm their health in a long time run.
Yeah, hydration is a real hot topic, let's call it, without meaning to make a pun. It's a complicated one and very controversial. So I think we've moved away from the idea that was popular in the 90s that, you know, you just have to drink as much as you can and the goal is to not lose any fluid. Mm-hmm. And that attitude is what led to people sort of doing a marathon and stopping every 10 minutes and pounding five glasses of Gatorade and ending up with hyponatremia, which is a dangerous condition that basically results from overdrinking, from drinking more than you need to. There are still people who need to worry about that because they're still over worried about hydration. But for the most part, that message has started sort of died down. Mm-hmm. Now, what sometimes happens and what some people advocate is a move completely away from worrying about hydration to saying dehydration is irrelevant. We have a very good system in our bodies that tells us when we need to drink. That's called thirst. If you're thirsty, drink. If you're not thirsty, don't drink. Mm-hmm. And don't worry about anything else. And I think as a general guiding principle, I think that's a good principle and that's generally the way I live my life.
Yeah.
But I think there are some circumstances where it's maybe not as good advice. Where, let's say you're running a marathon, you can't just drink whenever you're thirsty because there's only water stops every, let's say, 5K.
Right.
And you're also, let's say when you're running a marathon, you're really focused on your pace, your stomach isn't feeling great. So you're just less inclined to want to drink because you're focused on other things. So, and it's very individual. There's a lot of individual variation. Some people will still drink lots. Other people will drink way less than they ought to. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think in most circumstances, it's not as dangerous as we thought. You can be very dehydrated and you get to the end of the marathon, then you drink some fluids and a day later, you're fine. It can, in some circumstances, it might be a little more dangerous, in a hot weather marathon, say, or an ultra marathon. For the most part, what I would say is you don't necessarily need to have some sort of mission to drink, replace every drop of sweat you sweat out, because that's very hard to do. You should drink when you're thirsty, but the caveat that makes that feasible is you should be really careful to be aware of when you're thirsty. Mm. You should listen carefully to your body. And you shouldn't necessarily worry if you do lose some fluids, because that's your body can handle that. But you need to be careful to be listening to those signals so that thirst only works if you're paying attention to it.
I would like to make a recommendation here that people read this book, because it really helps give an objective. It's not saying do this or don't do this, just like you are not saying do this or don't do this in our talk. But it gives you maybe a broader perspective on how studies and how people have responded to this hydration question and what information is out there. And that's what we as runners should be looking into if we're serious about staying runners, staying healthy, having a happy life, all of that kind of stuff. Read the book and get a broader perspective.
I hardly endorse your suggestion that people should read the book. I think that's an excellent idea. But and more generally, just in terms of what you're saying about not it being all about do this or do that, but just sort of understanding the nuances. I think that's a great piece of advice, not just about hydration, but about all sorts of topics within running and health more generally. And I would sort of say, if you find yourself on one side of a really polarized debate and thinking that everyone who's on the other side is an idiot, that's maybe a sign that you're starting to think of this debate as a team sport. I'm on team only drink when you're thirsty. And so I have to argue against team, drink as much as you can. And I think the collective wisdom of humanity is such that generally being somewhere in the middle of most debates is often a pretty good place to be. And that's where I find, at least I say that because I find myself there pretty often on a lot of these debates.
I like the idea of observation as well and trying things on ourselves in kind of a controlled way. I think that's a good way to, to just check a few things out and see how it impacts us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'll say two things on that score. One is understand that we all have amazing capacity for self-delusion our personal experiences are definitely shaped by our expectations. If you pay a lot of money for something, you're going to be like, it definitely worked. It had to have worked. There's no way I paid a bunch of money for something that didn't work. So always be skeptical of your impressions. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, there's no better guide. You have to figure out whether it works for you. So I think you're absolutely right that ultimately you just have to try a few things and see what works best for you.
Yeah, see how it goes.
But without assuming that you're doing a scientific experiment. Really, what you're doing is just trying to find what seems to work best for you and being open to the possibility that there might be other ways.
It is fun for me as a coach to be able to see how other people respond to some of the same things that I think are either great or aren't great, but then you get more input. So a running group is also good for just observing what people are doing and how they're responding and how they're performing and getting their input as well. But we're getting short on time, and I want you to at least briefly go over the last three chapters of the book. Really, really great information. Training the brain, zapping the brain, and belief. Can you just kind of briefly give us some insight on those?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give you the ultra brief version. So, training the brain is in some sense what we talked about before. The idea of being able to specifically target the brain to make it get better at its role in pushing your limits of endurance. Whether that's the sort of crazy brain training that I tried, which I don't necessarily recommend, or whether it's through things like mindfulness, which is really getting a lot of attention these days for runners. Obviously, it's getting a lot of attention from everybody. It's a little overhyped, but there seem to be ways of specifically targeting the brain, and I think this is just an emerging area that we're going to hear a lot more about in the next few years. Zapping the brain is I wrote one chapter on this idea just because it was so wild, which is that you can basically hook up a 9-volt battery to your brain and run a weak electric current, and you can alter how the neurons talk to each other. And if you pick the right way area of the brain, you can alter your perception of effort. You can make exercise feel a little bit easier for about an hour or two. And this is a great example of what I was saying before, of things that I find intellectually interesting, but not necessarily what I am looking for from sport. and potentially sort of problematic or troubling from a sort of neurodoping perspective. But the evidence is still pretty preliminary on this, but I would say there is a there's reasonable evidence that you can alter your performance with brain stimulation. And to me, this is absolutely, in a sense, this is sort of the smoking gun proof that what feels like your physical limits is dictated in the brain, because you can do placebo-controlled, double-blind, sham experiments with this brain stimulation, and you find that the brain stimulation changes your physical limits. So how can they be in your muscle if all you're changing is how your neurons talk to each other?
Yeah, very interesting.
And the last chapter, I would say, is where the whole book comes together, because I've talked about all these ways of altering your sense of effort. And some of the things we've talked about, other things we haven't talked about, things like subliminal messages and facial expressions. And what I come to the conclusion is that what's underlying all these things, the most basic and fundamental way of altering your perception of effort to push your limits is to alter your belief, to have greater self-confidence. And so this sort of underlies a lot of sports psychology, things like motivational mm-hmm. self-talk. And it also, I think, is sort of indicative of what's special about Eliud Kipchoge, who we spoke about earlier. And so ultimately, to me, the message that I hope people come away from the book with is not, I should go buy this pill or invest in that brain stimulation device, but that how much I'm able to push myself and what the limits of my endurance are fundamentally a function of what's going on in my brain. And they respond to what I believe I'm capable of. So, and that's hopefully the case I make by the end of that chapter.
This week's episode is brought to you by Hemp Daddy, who makes full-spectrum CBD oils, lotions, and capsules to help you recover faster, sleep better, and reduce the pain from chronic injuries. As you learned in previous podcast episodes on CBD, CBD will not make you high and is non-toxic. It is even approved by the World Anti-Doping Agency. The biggest advantage of CBD for a runner like you is the anti-inflammatory properties. CBD can help your muscles heal and recover faster. Additionally, CBD can help you sleep better, which also leads to better rest and improved recovery times. And best of all, the results and effectiveness of CBD are backed by actual scientific research, something you know we value greatly. The reason we trust Hemp Daddy above other CBD providers is their commitment to quality and effective dosages. They use unbiased third-party labs to test their products so you can be 100% sure your CBD is safe and effective. If you want to see just how much CBD can improve your recovery, now is the time to give it a try. Just head over to runnersconnect.net/CBD to see the different options Hemp Daddy provides. Even better, Hemp Daddy is giving Runners Connect listeners a limited time special offer. So visit runnersconnect.net/CBD to take advantage before it's too late. Again, that's runnersconnect.net/CBD and use the code RTTT for the special offer. Bear Mattress is designed for your active running lifestyle. Bear mattresses are built for optimal cooling, comfort, and muscle recovery to help you fall asleep faster, stay asleep longer, and wake up feeling refreshed. Go to bearmattress.com/RTTT. That's bearmattress.com/RTTT. And get 20% off site-wide for their Memorial Day sale. Bear Mattress leverages insights from sleep experts, professional athletes, and engineers to create a super comfortable and supportive sleep surface. Bear Mattress uses FDA-determined Cellient technology, clinically proven to provide a more restful sleep, restore tired muscles, and improve your overall well-being. Buying a mattress in a store can cost thousands of dollars, but the Bear Mattress starts at just $440. Plus, it is made in the USA, sold online, and ships free right to your doorstep, making it easy and convenient for you. Buying a Bear Mattress online is completely risk-free with a 100-night in-home trial. You get 100 nights to try out the mattress, and if you don't absolutely love it, they'll pick it up and refund you 100% of your money. That's right, 100 nights, absolutely risk-free with no hidden charges or fees. Bear has over 5,000 five-star reviews from verified buyers and was named the best mattress for athletes by Sports Illustrated. Go to bearmattress.com/RTTT. That's B-E-A-R mattress.com/RTTT and get 20% off site-wide on their Memorial Day sale. Hello, we are back with Run to the Top podcast with Alec Hutchinson, author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Alex, are you ready to head into the final kick?
I hear the bell ringing. I'm ready to start sprinting.
Start the last lap. Okay, a favorite local run or outdoor location for working out in your neighborhood in Toronto?
Yeah, so I'll go with the one that's a block from my house, which is the Humber River. A hurricane came through in 1954 and flooded the floodplain. And so they got rid of all the buildings and now it's just a long linear park. And so I can run about 15 miles north, without crossing a road, just along in beautiful parkland, even though I'm in the middle of a city of 4 million. I see deer down there sometimes, coyotes, turtles. I can also run south about 3 miles and get to Lake Ontario and run along the lake there. So I run there almost every day just because it's my favorite place in the world to run.
Wow. It gets cold there sometimes, doesn't it?
Actually this winter it got, the river flooded and it got so iced over I had to find other places to run for a few months.
Yeah, to take a break from running there. Okay, so a recommended book, research, or video on endurance or brain training?
You know what, I'll give you a slightly different one just because one that shares the same spirit of scientific skepticism about endurance sports that I espouse. So it's a new book this year by Christy Eschwanden called Good to Go, what the athlete in all of us can learn from the strange science of recovery. So it's all about all the various ways we're pitched on how to recover after workouts, whether it's ice baths or float tanks or infrared pajamas from mm-hmm. Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. And it looks at the science and tries to understand what is it we're trying to do when we recover, what works, what doesn't, it takes a very scientific approach. So it's called Good to Go by Christy Eschwanden.
Great. And a person that you think might be willing to talk on our podcast and that would be of interest to our listeners.
I'll give you a two-person team, but you can get either one of them. Okay. Steve Magnus and Brad Stolberg. You may have had them on in the past. Steve is an elite track coach. He coaches at the University of Houston. Brad is a colleague of mine writing for Outside Magazine about performance. And they make a very interesting pair writing very thoughtfully about the sort of holistic big picture of trying to be our best and how to do that sustainably. So they had a book 2 years ago called Peak Performance and another one this year called The Passion Paradox. And they're very thoughtful and interesting guys to speak to.
Excellent. Okay, so we are really close to the end here. So give us contact information and how our listeners can stay in touch with you and also purchase your book.
Well, I'll start with the last and most important one. They can purchase my book pretty much anywhere. I, of course, encourage people to support their local bookstores. There's lots of great independent bookstores out there that make a big difference to supporting communities and promoting reading. But that being said, it's also available at all the big chains and Amazon, places like that. So it's called Endure and you can pick it up anywhere. The best place to keep in touch with me is on Twitter. My handle is sweatscience, all one word. And that's where I post about anything that I write or any other interesting articles I see. And I'm also happy to take questions and interact with people on Twitter. That's the easiest place. I have a website, alexhutchinson.net, that has a little more background detail on me and older articles, but it's not updated as frequently. Twitter is the kind of the place where it's all happening on a day-to-day basis.
Alex, thank you so much for talking with me today. This has been really great.
Thanks, Stephanie. I really enjoyed the conversation.
And you have been listening to Alex Hutchinson, journalist, researcher, athlete, and author of Endure, Mind, Body, and the Curiously Elastic Limits of Human Performance. Thank you, our audience, for joining us for today's podcast at Run to the Top. Please follow us at the Runners Connect Winner Circle on Facebook by going to runnersconnect.net/FB and subscribe to Run to the Top podcast at runnersconnect.net or on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. You'll be notified every week when the new episode is published. And thank you, each of you, for listening. We'll be back next week with another super interview to entertain, educate, and inspire you as you head out on your running workout. This is Stephanie K. Atwood, your host with Run to the Top, wishing you a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast from runnersconnect.net.